After supper, the nine of us found places to sit. I was in one of the armchairs with Scar curled up on the floor next to my feet. I'll start off by saying that I'm not going to give you a lot of details about some parts of this. They're still too painful for me to dwell on, even after all this time. But I'll tell you that there came a time when Harry and me, that's Harry Longaball, my best friend, him who folks called the Sundance Kid, there came a time when the two of us went to South America along with a female acquaintance of ours who was Harry's particular lady friend. Back in those days, when I was telling the story to the boys on the fish hook, the general public didn't know about the whole South America business, about how Harry and Etta and I went to Argentina and tried to make a go of it as honest ranchers. It was a number of years later when somebody wrote a story about it in another magazine, not the Police Gazette, that part of our lives came to light for most folks. Although friends and family knew where we'd gone at the time, of course. I'd written letters to some of them to tell them about it. Sitting there in the ranch house, I told my new friends about how the ranching hadn't worked out and how Harry and I had fallen back into our old larcenous habits, especially after Etta fell ill and had to return to the States. With just the two of us knocking around down there on the loose, the temptation was too much to resist. So we drifted over into Bolivia, robbed a few banks, and stuck up a mine payroll. When I got to that part, I looked at the neat stacks of bills still sitting on the table and thought about how they're cycles in all our lives, patterns that repeat themselves again and again, sometimes right out in the open, and sometimes so subtle you can't even see them unless you know how to look for them. Hitting that payroll turned out to be a mistake. The army was looking for us, and when we stopped in a little village called San Vicente to rest our horses and fix something to eat, the soldiers caught up to us. Somebody in the village pointed to the abandoned hut where we were staying and told the captain we were in there. He and the sergeant marched up and tried to arrest us, and Harry and me, well, we didn't want to be arrested. Even though it was nighttime and we were indoors as I was telling the story, I seemed to feel the hot sun on my face again. I heard the shots booming, smelled the sharp tang of powder smoke in my nose, relived the shock of a bullet hitting me. I could see as well the bright splash of blood on Harry's shirt. He was wounded a lot worse than I was. Even before he made an unsuccessful dash for the rifles we'd left outside and was hit several more times. The afternoon we spent holed up in that hut had seemed like a year instead. It's a hard thing to watch your best friend dying by inches. I didn't say much about that to Enoch and the others. Just told them that we traded shots with some soldiers and then took cover inside the hut. That evening, Harry died. If he'd been able to hang on until they charged us, I would have stayed there with him and died beside him. That was the kind of pars we were. But with him gone, there was no point in it. I managed to slip out in the dark, which is what I knew he would have wanted me to do. I heard talk later, while I was still in South America, about how they found us both dead in there and buried us in a cemetery close by. My hunch is that they didn't want to admit I'd gotten away, so they buried one of the soldiers who'd been killed in my place. I don't know if that's right, and I don't reckon anybody will ever know for sure. The only thing that's certain is that Harry Longaball, the Sundance Kid, died there, and I didn't.
What happened then? How did you get from there to here?
Oh, a lot of things went on that aren't very interesting. I was hurt and laid up for a while. Some of the Indians who lived down there took me in and cared for me until I got well enough to travel. There was nothing left for me in South America, so I went to Europe, knocked around there for a while. I finally came back to the States because I wanted to see some of my kinfolk again, and because I knew I needed to talk to Harry's lady friend and let her know the truth about how things ended up down there. I didn't want her hearing any rumors and not knowing the straight of things. I didn't spend a lot of time thinking about that part of it either. Etta and I had been good friends. Might have been more than that if she hadn't been with Harry. But she was hurt by the news I brought her and told me she didn't ever want to see me again. I'd honored that request, even though it pained me at times. Since then, I've just traveled around the country. Visited family now and then. Done a little gambling. Worked at jobs when I had to. My honest jobs, mind you. I thought my outlaw days were over. I even got a laugh now and then when I heard that some fella somewhere was claiming to be me. And that happened several times. I always thought, well, if that so-and-so is really Butch Cassidy, then the law should arrest him and send him to prison for all the things Butch Cassidy did.
Bet he would have changed his story in a pretty big hurry if that happened.
I expect you're right.
So if all this is true, how did you wind up here on the fish hook?
That's a whole other story. I gave it to him, starting with finding Abner Tillotson in that gully, and then settling the score with the Daughtry brothers for him.
I suppose it could have happened that way. That part about Butch Cassidy, I mean.
I believe you about the Daughtrys. They were a bad bunch. Probably everybody in this part of the country had heard of them, and most were glad when it looked like they pulled up stakes and moved on.
Then this ranch is legally yours.
I got the deed and a bill of sale signed by Abner. It's legally mine, all right.
And yet you risked it to help me and my mother.
Ride for the brand. That goes both ways.
Do you believe Mr. Strickland is really Butch Cassidy, Enoch?
I do. I bet this old hat of mine on it.
So do I. His story rings true as far as I'm concerned.
Sí, también.
Santiago's cousins nodded in solemn agreement.
Well, I'm not convinced. It doesn't really matter, does it? The train robbery is over and done with. Nobody got hurt, and Vince's mother ought to be all right now. It's over. Finished.
Well, I'm not so sure about that.
Just what did you have in mind, Jim?
That money's gonna come in mighty handy for Vince's ma, no doubt about that. That wasn't the only reason we decided to do this. What those fellas Kennedy and Milton did, cheating Mrs. Porter and having Rutledge spread those ugly rumors about Vince's pa being drunk, those things are just flat out wrong, and they deserve to pay for them.
The holdup's gotta be embarrassing for them.
One holdup's not all that embarrassing.
What are you saying, Mr. Strickland?
I think this new wild bunch of ours ought to ride again. Nothing much was said after that. It had been a long day, and I could tell they were going to have to mull it over. So I suggested that we all turn in. That would give them a chance to sleep on it. Since it was late, Santiago, Javier, and Fernando spent the night rather than returning to their spread, bedding down in the barn. The next morning, nobody seemed to want to bring up the subject, and I thought it might be wise not to push the issue. Vince needed to take that money to his mother, but I didn't want him riding all the way to the county seat by himself while he was carrying that much loot. After we'd eaten breakfast, the vaqueros headed for home, taking their shares with them.
Vince, why don't you and Enoch and I ride into town today? Gabe and Bert and Randy can hold down the fort here.
Why do you and Enoch need to go?
Nobody knows that we had anything to do with that train robbery. But even so, you might run into trouble carrying that much money. There are road agents who are always on the lookout for a fella traveling by himself.
Maybe there used to be. I'm not sure there are anymore.
Well, you don't ever know. I'd just feel better about it if you weren't riding by yourself.
All right. I'd like to get that money to my ma and have a talk with her about it. And I probably would get a little nervous about riding that far with it by myself. What you're saying makes sense, Mr. Strickland.
All right, then. We'll saddle up and ride. We started out early enough to make it to the county seat by early afternoon. We didn't stop in Largo, but headed straight on to town. When we got there, we went to the Porter house, where Vince's ma seemed surprised to see him. She gave him a hug, though, and nodded to me and Enoch.
Mr. Strickland, Mr. Cole, what brings all of you to town?
I've got something for you, Ma.
We had fixed up a money belt for Vince out of a piece of blanket so he could wear it under his shirt. He pulled it out now and set it on the dining room table.
What in the world is that?
What the railroad owes us.
All everybody in town is talking about this morning is that train robbery. Tell me you didn't have anything to do with that, Vincent. Please.
Vince didn't say anything. After 30 seconds or so, Mrs. Porter put her hands to her cheeks, and she sank down in a wing chair with a lace doily on the back.
Vince, no. You shouldn't have done such a thing.
It was the only way for us to get what's rightfully coming to us, Ma.
Only way for the railroad to get what it had coming, too.
What they're doing is wrong, but this isn't right either.
Maybe not in the eyes of the law, ma'am, but I'll tell you, it's justice. None of that money came from the passengers or from the mail sacks. No innocent person will suffer from losing it. The railroad will have to make it good, and it's the railroad's greed that cost you your husband. I'd say they could pay for a long time to come without squaring that debt.
Mr. Strickland, was this your idea?
Yes, ma'am, it was. So don't blame your boy. We pretty much forced him to go along with us, didn't we, Enoch?
That's not true. Well, the part about Mr. Strickland coming up with the idea is, but nobody forced me to do anything. I wanted to go along. I want Kennedy and Milton to have to answer to their bosses and try to explain how that payroll was lost on their watch.
Mrs. Porter clasped her hands together in her lap, looked down and shook her head. I thought she was going to be stubborn about the whole thing, but then she looked up, and I saw a hint of smile on her lips.
I imagine that was pretty awkward for them, all right.
Yes, ma'am, I bet it was.
I don't feel right about this, but to tell the truth, Bob's death really left us in a bind. I suppose I could take just enough to get by for a little while.
You need to take all of it. My part, too. I don't need it.
Vince went on to explain to her what I'd told him about not depositing the money in the bank just yet. She seemed to grasp the idea. She protested a little more about taking the loot, but I could tell she really wanted to, and I knew that in the end she would. It wasn't really a matter of the money. She just wanted to get back at Kennedy and Milton, as well she should have. Finally, it was all settled.
You have to promise me, Vince, that you'll never do anything this foolish again. You could have been hurt, or even killed.
I promise, Ma. I'll never again do what I did yesterday.
That seemed to satisfy her.
Can you spend the night?
I'm afraid not. We have to get back to the ranch. But I'll come to town for a visit again just as soon as I can.
I could tell she was disappointed that he wasn't staying. But she didn't try to talk him into it. Instead, she hugged him and shook hands with Enoch and me.
Anytime you gentlemen are in town, I'll be expecting you to stop by.
I reckon there's a good possibility of that, ma'am.
I'm going to make sure of it. I baked some sugar cookies this morning. I'm going to wrap them up and let you take them with you.
We surely won't turn down that offer, ma'am.
We had to go by the train station on our way out of town. And as we did, I saw Sheriff Lester standing in front of the door talking to three men I recognized as Rutledge, Kennedy, and Milton. All of them looked upset, and I felt a real satisfaction from seeing that. Lester didn't seem to notice us, and we didn't linger in the neighborhood of the depot. We'd gone a few miles along the dirt road that led to Largo when I spotted something up ahead. An automobile had pulled off to the side and stopped, and one of the flaps that opened on the front of it was lifted. Somebody wearing a long duster was bent over looking under the flap. Obviously, something had gone wrong with the contraption and it wouldn't run.
Looks like you got some trouble there, partner. Need some help?
The stranded hombre straightened up, turned around, and glared at me. And he was no hombre at all. He was a she, a fact that the long, shapeless duster had concealed. Her red hair was tucked up under a straw boater that was tied on her head with a scarf. So I hadn't had that clue either.
No, I don't need any help. In fact, I'm just fine, Mr. Strickland.
Begging your pardon, Miss Hatfield, but if that automobile won't go and you're a foot out here miles from town, you ain't fine.
Nonsense. I'll simply walk back to town and find someone to assist me.
You got three someones right here.
You mean you know how to repair an automobile?
Well, Daisy had me there. I looked at Enoch and Vince, and when they both shook their heads...
As a matter of fact, we don't, but I'd be glad to take a look at it and see if I can figure it out.
She stepped back and waved a slender hand at the workings underneath the flap.
Be my guest.
I swung down from the saddle, but it took me only a moment to realize I had gnawed off a lot bigger hunk than I could chew. I looked at all the wires and hoses and metal rods and knew it was hopeless. None of it made sense to me. What does it do?
Nothing. That's the problem.
No, I mean it was running, wasn't it? You got this far, so it must have been.
Yes, it was running, but then it just sputtered a couple of times and the engine stopped running. It rolled a few more feet, and I was able to get it over here on the side of the road, but that's all.
Does it have any of that foul-smelling stuff it runs on in it?
Oh, my word. I forgot to put gasoline in it. And I'll bet Father must have, too.
Preacher's daughters shouldn't gamble.
That's not what I meant. What am I going to do now?
We could tie our ropes to it and pull it, I suppose. 3 horses ought to be enough to get it rolling.
Could you take me back to town?
Why don't we just take you on to Largo? That's where you were headed, wasn't it?
Well, yes, but it would be closer to go back, wouldn't it?
Never go back when you can go ahead.
Davy Crockett said, be sure you're right, then go ahead.
Oh, all right, you've talked me into it. Once we get there, I can put gasoline in the tank with the new pump at Mr. Farnham's store.
Well, that's what I'd thought, too. Like all self-respecting cowboys, we never went anywhere without our lassos. We tied them securely to the front of the automobile, then dallied them around our saddle horns.
Where am I going to ride?
You can ride in the automobile. It'll go almost as fast with us pulling it as it does under its own power, I expect.
Why don't I ride with you?
Daisy opened the duster to reveal that she was wearing trousers.
I'm dressed for it, after all.
I'm surprised your pa would stand for a female relative being dressed in such a scandalous fashion.
I told him it was necessary in order to operate the machine properly. He's still frightened of it, so he didn't question me.
It would have been more apt for her to ride with Vince, since he was closer to her own age. But once I was in the saddle, I held my hand down to her and took my left foot out of the stirrup. We clasped wrists. She stepped up and swung a leg over the horse's back, like she'd been doing it all her life.
I used to ride when I was a little girl. I always loved it, but I haven't been on a horse in quite a while.
Come on out to the ranch sometime. We'll go riding.
That's not a bad idea.
Daisy slipped her arms around my waist to hang on and settled herself against me.
Vince, you get in the car and steer. Enoch can lead your mount.
Side by side, we urged the horses forward. The ropes tightened and the car started to move, its wheels turning fairly easily on the hard-packed dirt. We started moving along at a steady walk.
So, if your pa doesn't like automobiles, why'd he get one?
He thought it would allow him to cover more ground in his missionary work. He says we have to spread the word about the church in Largo.
Is that what you were doing in town? Spreading the word?
No. I went in to pick up some boxes of Bibles and hymnals that were delivered on the train yesterday. They're in the back of the car. Thank goodness those terrible men who held up the train didn't take them too.
Yeah, you know how owl hoots are about stealing hymnals.
I couldn't see her, but I suspected Daisy either glared at Enoch or stuck her tongue out at him. But I couldn't tell which.
Seriously, it's the talk of the town. Imagine, an old-fashioned train robbery in this day and age? I suppose some things never change. It's just human nature for some men to be greedy.
It's just human nature for some men to want to see justice done, too.
How could there be any justice in robbing a train?
If you'd ever had very many dealings with the railroad, you might know the answer to that question. How's the church building coming along, anyway?
Oh, not very well, I'm afraid. Father says that raising funds is always a challenge. But if it was easy, it wouldn't really be worth doing, would it?
What, he can afford to buy an automobile and a shipment of Bibles and hymnals, but he can't finish building the church?
Oh, he's always had trouble managing money. Numbers don't mean as much to him as words do. To be fair, though, he had ordered the car and the books before he knew he would run into difficulty raising the funds to finish the church.
Towing the car like that meant it was pretty slow going for us, but we made it to Largo by late afternoon. When we reached Largo, we hauled the automobile to the gas pump that stood to the side of Clyde Farnham's store. I saw the shell of the church at the edge of town. Just the skeleton of a building at the present time. Farnum must have seen or heard us coming. He walked out onto the store's porch.
Well, I'll swan. You run out of gas, Miss Hatfield?
It appears so. The car wouldn't go anymore.
Daisy slid down from my horse. Farnum picked up a long, skinny stick that was leaning against the wall and came down from the porch. He went over to the automobile and unscrewed something on it. He slid the stick down into a hole, rattled it around, and pulled it out.
Yep, dry as a bone. I'll fill her up.
Thank you. And you'll put the cost on my father's tab?
Yes, I sure will.
Farnum stuck a hose with a nozzle on it into the hole on the automobile, turned some sort of crank on the pump, and the sharp tang of gasoline filled the air as it ran into the tank. Vince got out of the car and untied our lassos from the contraption. I coiled mine and hung it on the saddle.
Thank you for your help, Mr. Strickland. I don't know what I would have done if you gentlemen hadn't come along.
You'd have figured out something. I've got a hunch you're pretty resourceful.
I've had to be.
Vince mounted up again. I looked over at him and Enoch. Why don't you boys head on out to the ranch? I'll catch up to you later.
What are you planning on doing?
I thought I'd help Miss Hatfield unload these boxes of Bibles and hymnals.
Oh, you don't need to do that. I can handle it, and you've already helped plenty today. There's no need for you to bother.
It's no bother, and it shouldn't take long. I don't mind.
Well, all right, if you're sure.
It'd take even less time if we all help.
The boss said get back to the ranch, so we'd best get back to the ranch. Good afternoon to you, Miss Hatfield.
Good afternoon, Mr. Cole. And to you too, Mr. Porter.
Ma'am.
Vince rode off with Enoch. Farnum finished putting gasoline in the car. He took a pad of paper and a stub of pencil from his pocket and made a note of some numbers he got from the pump. I knew he was going to add the total to Reverend Hatfield's bill, as Daisy had told him.
Want me to crank it for you?
Yes, please.
Daisy got behind the wheel. Farnum turned the crank, bending over and putting some elbow grease into it. My horse shied away from it. Daisy drove into the road and turned toward the boarding house. I followed her. When we reached the boarding house, the old woman who ran it was sitting in a rocking chair on the front porch.
Oh, land's sake, child, that thing is noisy.
I'm sorry if it disturbs you, Mrs. Higgins.
Daisy climbed out and went to the back. She lifted a lid there and reached in to pick up a box. By the time she did, I dismounted and looped my reins around the automobile's front bumper. I took the box from her. I got that.
Then I'll take another. I'm not going to let anyone do all my work for me.
Since there was no point in arguing with her, I didn't try. I just smiled and helped her carry a half a dozen boxes into the parlor, where we stacked them in a corner. I suppose Daisy's father had made arrangements with the landlady to store them there until the church was built. Mrs. Higgins was still sitting on the front porch, fanning herself when we finished with the chore and came back outside.
Your daddy asked me to tell you that he's down at the church, Daisy.
I'm not surprised.
Maybe you better go down there and let him know you got back all right. You might be worried since the trip took you longer than expected.
My father has a tendency to lose track of time. He probably hasn't even given my absence a thought. But I suppose it wouldn't hurt anything.
I'll walk down with you.
That's not necessary, Mr. Strickland.
I don't know. Largo can be a rough place sometimes.
I don't think I'll be in any danger. The Comanches are long since tamed, aren't they?
Yeah, but there are outlaws around. You know what happened to that train yesterday.
I suppose you're right. It's a free country. I can't stop you if you want to walk with me.
I untied my horse and led it as we started walking toward the partially completed church.
I thought you were going to call me Jim. You've been calling me Mr. Strickland all day.
I know. It just didn't seem... Please don't make fun of me for this. It just didn't seem proper to be calling you that in front of other people.
I reckon I can understand that. But we're alone now, Daisy.
We're also in the middle of the street in broad daylight, Jim. What do you expect me to do? Throw myself in your arms and kiss you like that brazen hussy at the dance did?
I was sort of fond of that brazen hussy.
Damn it, Hatfield, I've been waiting long enough. When are you going to put up some money on account?
Oh, no, Father.
Sounds like he's arguing with somebody.
No, he doesn't argue with people. That's not like him. But that doesn't stop other people from getting angry with him sometimes.
We better find out what it's about. I took hold of her arm and started walking faster toward the church. Daisy had to hurry to keep up with my long-legged strides. Nobody was inside in front of the framework, which had all four sides and the ceiling joists in place, but was lacking the rafters and the roof. I spotted several men behind the place, though, and one of them was Reverend Franklin Hatfield. The other man was a stranger to me. A burly sort in work boots, khaki trousers and a shirt, and a battered brown fedora. His sleeves were rolled up over brawny forearms. Two other men in work clothes were standing a few yards behind him, but they weren't taking any part in the ruckus, at least not yet. Off to one side was a truck with slat sides around the bed.
Excuses won't pay my bills. I don't care if you are a man of the cloth. You've got to pony up for that load of lumber.
Please, Brother Nelson.
I'm not your brother, and I'm not my brother's keeper, neither. You better come up with the money you owe me right now, or else.
Or else what?
What?
That's what I'm asking you. What are you going to do if you don't get paid, Looks to me like all those boards are already nailed together. You gonna pull all the nails, load up the boards, and haul them off? You won't be able to sell them for new anymore. And a lot of them will likely be too damaged from being pulled apart to be good for anything. So, I'll ask you again. What are you gonna do?
Who the hell are you?
Please, Brother Nelson, no intemperate language.
I asked you who the hell you are!
Seems like neither one of us like to answer questions much, but I'll go first. My name's Strickland. I'm a friend of the Reverend and his daughter.
You know good and well I'm not going to tear down that church, Strickland. Although I might consider it if I'm pushed far enough. But you can damn well bet that I'll never bring any more lumber out here for this Bible-thumping deadbeat. Not only that, I'll spread the word through the whole county and make sure nobody else sells him any lumber either. That church won't ever be finished.
How much money you have coming to you?
$500.
I put my hand in my pocket.
Jim, what are you doing?
I didn't answer her. Instead, I pulled out a roll of bills. When I held out the money toward Nelson, he reached for it instinctively. I could have decked him then, but instead I slapped the roll down into his palm. I don't have that much on me, but there's a couple hundred on account. I'll see to it you get the rest. My name's Jim Strickland, and I own the Fishhook Ranch. Everybody in these parts knows me and will vouch for me.
Jim, no.
Mr. Strickland, that's very generous, but I can't allow you to...
Just call it a donation, Reverend. Folks donate money to churches all the time, don't they?
Yes, but this isn't really a church yet.
What's it say in the good book? Wherever two or more are gathered in my name? You and Miss Hatfield make two, I reckon. And there are plenty more folks around here who come to services once the church is finished.
Are you saying you'll pay the preacher's debt?
I think you must have been out in the sun too long, amigo. That's exactly what I'm saying.
Well, then, all right.
Looks to me like the Reverend could use another load of lumber out here. You figure out what he needs to finish the church, deliver it, and leave the bill with Farnham over at the store. I'll pick it up next time I'm here and settle up with you. Do we have a deal?
It's a deal.
Nelson shoved the roll of bills in his pocket. All right. Just so we're clear on that, in front of witnesses.
What the hell you mean by that?
I just don't want you trying to back out on it when I do this. I punched him in the jaw. He staggered back and would have fallen down if the two men with him hadn't caught hold of him.
What the hell was that for?
You shouldn't have been talking to a preacher that way. You had no right to call him names. And you cussed too much in front of a lady. You had it coming.
Obviously, Nelson didn't see it that way. He jerked his arms free and charged at me. He grabbed me in a bear hug, and we both wound up falling to the ground in a welter of dust. We broke apart and rolled away from each other. My hat had gone flying off my head, and so had Nelson's. revealing his thinning brown hair. As he came up on one knee, he waved the other men back.
This is between me and Strickland. Stay out of it.
One of the men shrugged, and they both moved back to give us room.
Gentlemen, please. This is going to be the Lord's house. It's no place for brawling.
Nelson and I didn't pay any attention to him. We surged to our feet. Nelson was a big, tough hombre and had a couple of inches and probably 30 pounds advantage on me. But I wasn't in a very forgiving mood myself, and I was considerably quicker than he was. His head rocked back from those, and blood spurted from his nose when my fist landed on it the third time. While he was a little off balance from that, I swung my right and buried it in his gut. He folded up and went straight to the ground. I turned around quick-like, fists still clenched toward the other two men Nelson had with him.
Whoa, whoa, take it easy, Strickland. The boss said this was between you and him. We'll be happy to leave it that way.
Jim, are you all right?
Yeah, I'm fine. He didn't hardly lay a hand on me. I couldn't let that fella get away with talking ugly like he was.
That doesn't matter. Words are no excuse for such brutality.
Look out!
I turned around to see that Nelson was climbing to his feet. When he made it upright, he spread his legs a little, planting his boots so he wouldn't sway, and dragged the back of his left hand across his face, smearing the blood that had leaked from his nose. He looked at the blood and suddenly grinned.
Is it broken?
More than likely.
Think you can set it?
I'll give it a try.
I went over to Nelson, took hold of his nose, and pulled on it. When I let go and stepped back, his nose was reasonably straight again.
Thanks. I was ugly enough already without making it worse.
Nelson pulled a bandana from his back pocket and used it to wipe away more of the blood from his face.
You're a handful, you know that? I haven't lost a fight in a long time.
Whew, I'm not surprised. You got a punch like the kick of a mule.
I'll have another load of lumber out here tomorrow. And if the Reverend needs more, he can just let me know.
I'll see to it you get paid.
No hurry. I know you're good for it. I'll cut the price a little, seeing how it's for a good cause.
I'm obliged to you for it. I can't speak for the good Lord, but I figure he might be too.
Sorry for the rough talk, Reverend. I'm used to dealing with men who try to cut corners and take advantage of me. I should have known you weren't like that.
Well, that's all right, Mr. Nelson. Thank you for your consideration.
Let's go.
One of Nelson's men climbed into the truck cab with him, while the other one went to the front of the vehicle. And turned the crank to start it. Then he hopped into the back and Nelson drove off, leaving a cloud of dust behind him.
What in the world was that?
Mr. Nelson changed his tune because he was afraid of Mr. Strickland.
I hate to disagree with you, Reverend, but Nelson wasn't scared of me. He respected me, and that's what made the difference. I treated him with respect, too, and didn't rub it in his face that I'd whipped him. He'll be a friend from now on.
I will never understand men.
Now, I really can't allow you to pay the expenses for this church. It's not fair to you.
They say the Lord works in mysterious ways, don't they, Reverend? Well, just consider me one of those mysterious ways.
But how can you afford such a thing?
Don't you worry about the money. Anytime I need money, I know more than one way to get it.
Daisy wanted me to have supper with him and spend the night in Largo. I refused the offer as politely as I could, reminding her that I'd told Enoch and Vince I'd catch up with them after I helped her unload the Bibles and hymnals. It was probably too late for me to do that, but if I didn't show up at the ranch until the next day, they and the rest of the crew would probably start to worry. It was after dark before I reached Fish Hook. Scar heard me coming and ran out to meet me.
Hush, Scar.
Lamps were lit in the bunkhouse, so it didn't surprise me when the fellas heard Scar's carrying on and came out to see what the commotion was all about. Randy, Vince, and Bert were in the lead, but Enoch and Gabe hung back a little, their right hands resting on their gun butts.
Hello, the camp!
Figured you wouldn't get in any hurry helping that gal with her Bibles and hymnals.
I swung down from the saddle and handed the reins to Randy.
There was a little more to it than that.
You ain't engaged, are you?
What? Of course not.
Then what happened? I thought you said you'd be right behind us. Enoch told me not to worry, though.
This doesn't have anything to do with the sheriff, does it?
Come on in the house, all of you. I'll explain it in there. We got some things to talk about, but we might as well be comfortable.
Once Randy had put up my horse and we were all inside and settled, I told him about the fracas with Nelson and the preacher's money troubles.
So, I think we ought to pitch in and help get that church built by holding up another train.
Putting those two things together sort of doesn't make sense, Mr. Strickland. One of the Ten Commandments says, "Thou shalt not steal."
But don't the Bible also say something about robbing from the rich and giving to the poor?
That's Robin Hood. That's just something from a storybook.
Maybe so, but you gotta admit, there's something to be said for the idea. We were already talking about hitting another train.
You were talking about it, Mr. Strickland, not us.
Sounds like a mighty good idea to me.
You just want an excuse to rob trains.
Sounds to me like we could do a lot of good. There's bound to be plenty of folks besides the preacher who could use some help, too. If we gave most of the loot to people who really needed it, I don't see how El Señor Dios could be too upset with us.
I'm willing to put it to a vote. Santiago and his cousins ain't here, so we'll have to see how they feel about it later. But right now, who amongst us thinks it would be a good idea to hold up another train and use the money to pay for Reverend Hatfield's church?
I lifted my hand. So did Enoch and Gabe. I'd been pretty sure I could count on them. I was a little surprised when Bert's hand went up as fast as it did, though. Vince looked at him, shrugged, and lifted his hand too.
I don't care that much about the church, but I've got no reason to love the railroad.
What about the promise you made to your ma? I wouldn't want you to go against that and be sorry about it later.
I promised her I'd never again do what I did yesterday. So you can't have me holding the horses again, Mr. Strickland.
You were using your head there, son.
That just left Randy. I looked at him.
You've already got a majority, Mr. Strickland. Suppose I might as well go ahead and make it unanimous.
I don't think you'll regret it, Randy. We'll need to leave somebody here like we planned to before, and you can have that job. Only you'll really stay here this time, because I think we'll be gone for a few days. And I don't want to leave this place unattended for that long.
Planning on getting out of Sheriff Lester's bailiwick for the next job, are you?
I think it would be a good idea. We don't want anybody to track us down, so I figure we'll spread the jobs out far and wide.
Jobs?
This'll be just the start, boys. Why, in the old days, Sundance and me, along with the rest of the bunch, ranged all over. That's the way to do it. Never let the law pin you down. That's the way it was in the hole-in-the-wall days.
Once we were committed to the idea of robbing another train, an idea that Santiago and the Gallardo boys had gone along with quite happily, by the way, I did quite a bit of scouting before settling on the location, more than 100 miles west of our usual stomping grounds around Fishhook. It was far enough away from the ranch that it wouldn't draw suspicion on us right away, and it was a place where we could stop the train without wrecking it. On the morning of the robbery, Santiago and I went up to a cliff overlooking the railroad tracks with Bert and Vince and showed them where to plant the dynamite. The two youngsters had the job of setting off the explosion that would dump 20 tons of rock on the tracks and force the train to stop. Also, from that vantage point, they could pitch in with some rifle fire if we got into trouble and needed somebody to cover our retreat once the job was finished. Which is how, a couple of weeks after suggesting the job, I was waiting on horseback behind some massive boulders about 50 yards north of the railroad tracks. On the other side of the tracks rose a steep cliff, and as I took off my hat and edged my head around the big slab of rock so I could peer up at the top of the cliff, I spotted Bert standing there looking down at the boulders. I waved my hat at him,
and he waved his to let me know that everything was all right up there. I pulled back behind the boulders, put my hat on, and checked my pocket watch. If the train was on schedule, right about now it would be starting the long climb up a slope to the east of our position. It would have to slow down to make that climb, and that was vital to our plan. If the train had been highballing along, it might not have been able to stop in time. The train was right on schedule, or close enough for government work anyway. Not that what we were doing was government work. When it came to large-scale thievery, 100 wild bunches couldn't match even a fraction of the larceny that politicians in Washington pull off on a daily basis. Better get ready, fellas. I looked over to the 5 men with me. We all pulled our bandanas up over our faces. Santiago, Javier, and Fernando were all wearing regular cowboy clothes and Stetsons today, as well as long tan dusters, instead of their vaquero garb and sombreros. That might help deflect suspicion from them later, I thought. The boulders concealed us well enough that the engineer and fireman wouldn't be able to see us. I'd measured off the distances as best I could. A quarter of a mile up the track, I had gathered some rocks and stacked them into a small cairn that would be visible through binoculars from the ridge. Vince's job was to watch that cairn, and as soon as the locomotive's cowcatcher passed it, he was to signal Bert, who would push down the plunger attached to the dynamite. I estimated that the train would have time to stop before it crashed into the resulting avalanche, but not by much. We had to cut it that close so that the engineer couldn't stop the train and then try to reverse it before we closed in on the cab. Come on! I kicked my horse into a run and we broke out from behind the boulders. As we left the shelter of rocks, I saw a huge cloud of dust and smoke boiling up from the top of the cliff. Great chunks of rock and dirt had broken off and were sliding down the slope toward the tracks. More dust rose as the small-scale avalanche crashed down and swept across the steel rails, covering them completely. The cowcatcher was just shuddering to a halt about 20 feet short of the first slabs of rock across the tracks as we swung down from our saddles. The fireman started to lift his shovel threateningly. I sent a bullet over his head.
Drop it. Now climb down from there, both of you.
With Gabe and me covering them, the engineer and fireman didn't have any choice. Gabe herded them away from the engine.
I got them. You can go about your business.
I hurried along the train and was just passing the first of the passenger cars. I scrambled up onto the platform and burst through the door. Santiago stood at the head of the aisle running between the bench seats. A man in the blue uniform of a conductor sat on the floor about halfway down the aisle. His cap had fallen off. He clutched his right shoulder with his left hand. I saw the bright red flash of blood between his fingers.
You all right?
Yeah. He pulled a gun and opened fire on me. I had to stop him.
I'm glad you didn't have to kill him. You got this under control.
I don't think anyone else would cause us any trouble.
I went back out. Enoch was already waiting for me outside the express car.
The conductor wasn't in the caboose.
I know. One of our boys ran into him in the first passenger car.
Anybody hurt? I thought I heard some shots.
The conductor's got a bullet hole in his shoulder, but he'll be all right.
Well, that's good. I just assumed nobody died.
I felt the same way. The express messenger didn't need to know that, though.
Open up, or it'll go mighty hard for you when we get in there.
I nodded to Enoch. We stepped back, moving in different directions, so we flanked the doorway, just in case the messenger tried to come out shooting. Far from it. Instead, he tossed out a shotgun, followed by a small caliber revolver.
There's nothing in here worth dying over. Don't shoot, all right?
Climb down out of there, son. We'll hold our fire as long as you don't try anything foolish.
No chance of that.
He lowered himself to the ground. He was young, not much more than 20, and looked more scared than angry. I glanced toward the engine. Gabe had the engineer and the fireman turned around so that their backs were to us and couldn't see what was going on. And we were far enough away that they probably couldn't hear the conversation either.
Keep him covered.
I holstered my gun and picked up the shotgun. The express messenger started to look more nervous. I pointed the shotgun into the air, angling it away from the train, and fired off both barrels. Then I tossed the empty weapon back on the ground.
There you go. When your bosses ask you about what happened, tell them you put up a valiant fight. Both barrels of that greener are empty to prove it. But after that, the outlaws overpowered you. Got it?
Yeah, I guess so. But why would you worry about what my boss is thinking of me?
Because there wasn't anything else you could have done here except die. And like you said, there's nothing in there worth dying for. A man doesn't deserve to lose his job just because he's being sensible.
Well, all right. I appreciate it, I guess.
I tell you what we'll do. We'll even blow open the safe so you won't have to open it for us. I saved a stick of dynamite for that.
Thanks. Can I say that I threatened you and told you that you won't get away with this?
Why, sure, son. You tell them whatever you want. Hell, there won't be anybody around to contradict you, will there?
Enoch kept the youngster covered, just in case, while I climbed into the express car and blew the door off the safe. There was no big money shipment this time, but I found some assorted packets of bills and stuffed them in the inside pockets of my duster. With that taken care of, I hopped out of the car and nodded to Enoch.
We'll be leaving now. Pleasure doing business with you.
Well, thanks again, mister. I hope if a train I'm on is ever robbed again, it's you who does the holding up.
Another testimonial from a satisfied customer. You stay right there, here.
I won't budge from this spot.
Enoch and I hurried to our horses. That was the signal for Gabe and the three vaqueros to light a shuck, too. We all leapt into our saddles and got out of there as quick as we could. Up on the cliff, Bert and Vince were watching us go, I hoped, and would meet up with us later at the rendezvous point, a rugged hill 5 miles north. I worried about those two until I saw them come trotting up an hour or so later. They had to circle around to get down from the cliff and avoid the scene of the robbery, so their route had been longer than ours.
Good to see you boys.
Everything went just perfect, Mr. Strickland, just like you told us it would.
I've been doing this for a while. Robbing trains is like anything else. You got to practice to do it right.
How much did we get?
A whole $1,708.
That was less than $200 per man. But in those days, even that sum represented several months of wages for a cowboy. Anyway, it didn't matter, because we'd all agreed that most of it would go to Reverend Hatfield for the church in Largo. Satisfied that we'd done a good day's work and that the law wasn't after us at the moment, we turned our horses toward home. The next few months were the happiest I'd been since the early days in Argentina with Harry and Etta. We hit 5 more trains, traveling as far as New Mexico to hold up one of them. The take was never less than 2 grand, and one glorious day, it was almost 28,000. The First Methodist Church of Largo, Texas was finished now, with its white painted walls, its towering steeple, and its bells that sounded the call to worship every Sunday. I usually attended the services, sitting in one of the front pews with Daisy and sharing a hymn book with her as we sang along with the rest of the congregation. Her father had bought a small house in Largo to use as a parsonage, and of course the money from the holdups paid for that too, although the Reverend would have been horrified if he'd known. Franklin Hatfield wasn't the only one we helped, of course. Clyde Farnham hit a rough patch when one of the companies that had been supplying the groceries he carried was sold, and the new owner called in all the debts. Farnham needed a loan to tide him over, and I supplied it, telling him to just pay me back when he could and not to worry about it. Now, I didn't know if I'd ever see any of that money again, but I didn't care. Santiago also knew several Mexican farmers who were about to go bust, and we slipped them enough money to keep going. I did likewise with several small ranchers in the area who had financial reverses. When Tom Mulrooney needed a new forge for his blacksmith shop, I made sure that he got it. Every time I helped someone, I told them to keep it to themselves where the assistance came from. But I suppose word got around anyway, at least to a certain extent. I couldn't go anywhere without folks nodding to me and smiling, and I figured I knew the reason why. Now that was skirting on the thin edge of danger, and I knew it. The fish hook was a good spread, but it wasn't any better than a lot of the others, and there was no reason at all to be more prosperous. I knew Sheriff Emil Lester was a relatively smart man. If he heard that I was handing out money right and left, he might start to wonder where it was coming from. I took chances with Daisy Hatfield, too, and that did sort of trouble me. She would rent a horse from Mulrooney, and then we would meet out on the range to ride together. Or I would come to her father's house in Largo when he was off in the far corners of the county doing his visitations. We were careful about those meetings. Daisy claimed she didn't care all that much about her reputation, but I did. I wanted to protect her as much as I could, and that included not letting ugly rumors spread about her. But I couldn't stay away from her. I argued with myself up one way and down the other that I was too old for her. I said that very thing to her on a number of occasions.
I've told you that I'm older than my years, Jim Strickland, and you're younger than yours. That way we sort of meet in the middle. Anyway, there are plenty of couples in my father's congregation where the husband is in his 30s or 40s and the wife is barely out of her teens. Besides, I'm 24 years old. I'm practically an old maid.
It was a struggle, but we kept some boundaries in place. And that was how it went, that summer of 1915. One day, when we were out riding, we stopped on top of a rise that looked down a long valley stretching for miles between low, rolling hills. Fishhook was at the far end of that valley. Daisy had brought along a blanket and a picnic basket. She spread the blanket on the grass, and we sat down to eat while our horses grazed. The sun was pretty warm, so I was grateful for the shade of a cottonwood tree. Daisy was lovely in a white blouse and dark green riding skirt. I'd never seen anything so pretty in my life.
You're staring at me, Jim.
Am I? I was just wondering how a beautiful young girl like you wound up with a worn-out old varmint like me.
Stop that. You say things like that nearly every time we're together, and I don't like it. You know that's not the way I feel about you.
There's no getting around the facts. When I was born, George Custer was still 9 years away from meeting up with the Sioux at the Little Bighorn. By the time you were born, the West as I first knew it was almost gone. The little bit of it that's left is fading away with every day that passes.
How can you be so melancholy on such a beautiful day?
I'm not trying to be. It's just that sometimes I think maybe I'm fighting a losing battle. Trying to hold back time.
Isn't that what we're all doing, though? Looking for happiness, even though we know by its very nature that it's fleeting and doomed to end?
Shoot, now I've made you gloomy.
I know a good antidote for doom and gloom that will work on both of us. Kiss me.
That sounds like good medicine, all right. Let me have a sample. I don't know if it works or not, but it tastes a whole heap better than castor oil.
I think you need to increase the dosage.
Better too much than not enough. Well, we carried on like that for a while. Then we finished what was left of the picnic, put everything away, and folded the blanket. As we were about to mount up, Daisy paused and gazed off down the valley for a long moment.
Do you sometimes wish that the world could stay just the way it is at a particular moment, Jim? That the good things could just go on and on the way they are just then?
That's a mighty pretty thing to think about, all right. But it was impossible. Nothing stayed the same for long, especially the good things. There was always a snake slithering into the garden somewhere. In this case, that snake was named Simon Barstow. The railroad was not happy with me. To be specific, Lewis Kennedy and Albert Milton weren't happy with me. Every time I went to Farnham's store, I picked up the newspaper from the county seat, as well as the papers from San Antonio. And every time after we pulled a job, Kennedy and Milton would be quoted spouting off to reporters about how outraged they were by the robberies and how this wave of crime and degradation would soon come to a halt. I intended to keep it up long enough to get those two no-account buzzards fired. Desperate men are dangerous, though. And Kennedy and Milton, despite all their blustering,
really did intend to put up a fight. They couldn't do it on their own, though. They had to have help. That's why they sent for Simon Barstow. Understand, I didn't know all this at the time. I'd never even heard of Barstow. He had risen to prominence in the Pinkertons while I was in South America, and then in Europe. He'd made a name for himself catching bank robbers back east, and it stood to reason that eventually the Pinks would send him west. He'd busted up a gang in Iowa and another in Missouri. It was while he was in St. Louis that he'd gotten his first crack at train robbers. He chased them all the way to Pine Bluff, Arkansas, and caught up to them there. With a half a dozen other Pinkerton detectives, he'd raided the gang's hideout and wiped them out in a fierce gun battle, recovering most of the loot they'd stolen. I read all about it later on. You can look him up if you want. His picture is in the newspapers and magazines from those days. He was a handsome man, with dark hair, piercing eyes, a strong nose, and a thick black mustache waxed to sharp points on the tips. Kennedy and Milton must have been as impressed as all get out when Barstow strode into Kennedy's office in San Antonio, gave him a firm handshake, and promised to bring justice to the scoundrel who was causing them so much trouble, namely me. And if I resisted, Barstow intended to send the villain straight to hell by any means necessary. Meanwhile, blissfully ignorant, I started planning our next holdup. Reverend Hatfield's church had a piano to play along with the hymn singing, but I thought it would be nice if there was an organ, too. I hadn't settled on a time and place to pull the next job when we got word that John Hamilton had died down in the county seat. He had battled that gut rot, as he called it, longer than anybody expected him to. Vince's mother called Farnham's store, since that was where the only telephone in Largo was located. Farnham told Reverend Hatfield, and the Reverend drove out to the fish hook to break the news to Vince, since Hamilton and Vince's dad had been best friends.
I ought to go to the funeral. Mr. Hamilton was like an uncle to me.
I'll ride down with you. Hamilton seemed like a good fella, and he stuck by your dad's memory when there was all that trouble. And that's for sure.
Bert wanted to go too. Since the funeral was going to be held the next morning, the three of us started for the county seat that afternoon, intended to ride well into the night to get there. Vince told us his ma likely would be offended if we didn't spend the night there, so that's where we headed. Mrs. Porter was glad to see Vince, and she made me and Bert feel welcome too, as we sat in her parlor.
I was hoping you'd come. Your father would have wanted you here to help say goodbye to his old friend.
That's what I thought.
Mrs. Porter got up and went over to a little table with a drawer underneath it. She opened the drawer, took out an envelope, and handed it to Vince.
He left this for you.
Who? Mr. Hamilton?
That's right. It was in his room with his other things. The sheriff brought it over this morning.
I saw that the envelope was sealed and had Vince's name written on it. He tore it open, unfolded the piece of paper inside, and started to read. I could tell by the way his eyes widened that the words written on the paper shocked him.
Is there something wrong, dear?
Vince shook his head, put the letter back in the envelope, and slipped it into his pocket.
No, Mr. Hamilton just wanted to tell me again not to believe any of the things that were said about Dad.
Well, that was thoughtful of him, to do something like that while he was on his deathbed.
Yeah.
Vince was staying in his old room, of course. The house was small and didn't have a guest room, but there was a sleeping porch at the back with a cot. Bert would stay there, and Mrs. Porter made up the sofa for me. I was about ready to turn in when Vince came into the room, quiet-like, carrying the envelope with the letter from John Hamilton. He held it out to me.
Boss, you'd better look at this.
The only lamp in the room still burning had been turned down low. I turned it up again, brightening the glow until I could make out the words scrawled on the paper in the shaky writing of a man on his deathbed.
Vince, I know what you've been doing, son. You and your friends from that ranch. Don't worry. I'll soon take that secret to my grave. I would never betray you. But before I go, I want you to know something. My friends from the railroad and from Wells Fargo still visit me. And one of them let something slip the other day. Next Friday afternoon's westbound train will be carrying a shipment of gold bullion headed for the Federal Reserve Bank in El Paso. $60,000 worth. You can take it at the same place you took that very first train.
You believe this about the gold bullion?
Yeah, I do. Before he had to retire because he got sick, Mr. Hamilton was in charge of freight operations for this whole section of the line. He knew everybody, and they all trusted him with good reason. He was as honest as they come.
But he's telling us to hold up that train.
Keep reading.
The only reason I'm telling you this is because of those greedy, cold-hearted bastards Kennedy and Milton. Losing that gold shipment will be the last straw for the railroad. Kennedy and Milton will be fired, and it's a fate they will deserve. You and your friends have done a lot of good for others, Vince. Think of the good you can do with that much money.
You sure this is Hamilton's handwriting?
Yes, sir. I saw it on the chalkboard in the station often enough.
And you trust him? This couldn't be some sort of trick.
I can't imagine him doing that. Not after he and my dad were friends for so long. You've got to understand, Mr. Strickland, my father was a brakeman. Mr. Hamilton didn't work with him. They didn't have to be friends, but they were, because they genuinely liked and respected each other.
I looked back down at the letter and read.
If I've guessed wrong about you and your friends being responsible for those train robberies, I hope you'll forgive me. Consider it just a figment of a sick old man's imagination. But if it's the truth, then take what I've told you and do with it what you will. I know I can count on you to do the right thing, son. Your friend, John Hamilton.
Well, that's mighty interesting.
What I can't figure out is how he knew what we'd been doing.
A good guess, I'd say. I just hope the sheriff doesn't make the same guess one of these days.
A job like this, if we pulled that off, we could afford to stop. We'd have enough money to help everybody who needed helping, and the fish hook could just be a ranch again.
I don't know.
It's been really exciting, and we've done a lot of good, but it had to come to an end sooner or later, Mr. Strickland. I'm just a kid, and I know that.
I handed the letter back to Vince. I'm not making any promises, but we'll look into it. And if it works out, you're right, son. We can go back to being honest citizens. When we got back to the ranch after the funeral, I had a chore for Enoch. I want you to fetch Santiago and the Gallardo brothers.
What's this all about? Got a mighty serious look on your face, Jim.
I'd rather just tell it once. When Enoch got back with the vaqueros, I gathered everybody around me in the house while I stood there with Scar lying on the floor at my feet and read John Hamilton's letter out loud to him.
What are you trying to tell us, senor? That we should stop being outlaws because this man Hamilton knew our secret?
That ain't what he's saying at all. He's saying we ought to go after that shipment of gold bullion.
Actually, I'm sort of saying both those things. Damn right I think we should go after that bullion. Once we got our hands on it, that'll be the right time to retire as train robbers.
60 grand's a hell of a lot of money, all right.
We wouldn't get that much out of it. You can't just go into a store and spend a bar of gold. We'd have to sell it to somebody who can deal with it, and they won't give us the full value of what it's worth. But I figure we'll clear at least half, maybe more. We won't have to sell it all at once, either. We'll get more in the long run if we spread it out. But when all's said and done, it would still be a fine way to close out our train robbing career.
Do we get to vote again?
I've never tried to make you fellas do anything you didn't want to do. You may work for me as ranch hands, but we're all equal partners in this other business. So, yeah, sure, we'll take a vote.
Then I vote yes. I want to get this over with. And I want to be a part of it this time instead of sitting here on the ranch. Hate being stuck here, not knowing if you're all going to get shot full of holes or not.
That ain't exactly what I'd call a vote of confidence, but I'll take it. How about the rest of you boys?
I'm in.
You can count me and Bert in.
Me too.
See?
What do you think about Hamilton suggesting that we hit the train at the same place we did that first one?
It might work. We've been riding pretty far and wide on these jobs. They might not expect us to circle back to where we started.
It's closer to town than the ranch.
True. But if we take them by surprise, that shouldn't really matter. We got some time. I'll do some scouting and planning. That's all been working out right so far, so I don't see any reason to change.
With that settled, Santiago and his cousins went back to their spread. Santiago told me to let them know when we were ready to make our move. That was a Tuesday, so Friday was 3 days off.